We will call the House Senate Joint Tax Conference Committee to order. We'll be going over side by side today on House File 42. What I'd like to do first of all, I think we're going to be spending a lot of time together here, so we should have maybe everybody make an introduction so we can get to know who we are and who we're representing. And we're very fortunate today to have Commissioner Franz with us, and so we'll just start on that side and we'll just go around the table.
Good morning, Chair Davids and Chair Orban. Glad to be here. My name is Myron Franz, Commissioner of Revenue, and on my right is Assistant Commissioner of Tax Policy, Matt Mossman. Thank you.
Susan Von Mosch, Senate Fiscal.
Jack Paulson, Senate Counsel and Research.
Joanne Zoff, Senate Counsel, Research and Fiscal.
Oops. Nora Pollack, Senate Counsel and Research.
Roger Chamberlain.
Julie Rosen.
Dave Sendrum.
Jamie Yost, Legislative Assistant to Senator Ortman.
Deb Cadoon, Senate Committee Administrator.
Good morning and welcome. I'm Julianne Ortman. I'm the Chair of the Senate Tax Committee.
Greg Davids, Chair of the House Tax Committee.
Bobby Patrick, Tax CA.
Sarah Anderson.
Linda Runbeck.
And Lynn Chesky.
Joel Michael from House Research.
Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal.
Kathy Schill, House Fiscal.
Steve Hines, House Research.
Pat Dalton, House Research.
Nina Manzi, House Research.
Karen Baker, House Research.
Welcome, everyone, to this morning's first conference committee meeting. We will be starting out with side-by-sides. We'll be starting out with the individual income tax. So if I could call Nina Manzi to the table, and then these... Nora Pollack. And welcome to the committee, Ms. Manzi and Ms. Pollack. If you could please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nina Manzi from House Research. I think we'll just alternate on House and Senate provisions. Article 1 of the House bill provides for the Commissioner of Revenue to share data with the Wisconsin Secretary of Revenue for purposes of conducting a new income tax reciprocity benchmark study.
Hey, Ms. Manzi, Ms. Pollack, and everyone, if we could speak in the microphone, it's a little hard to hear here, so if you could get the microphone a little closer, that'd be wonderful. Thank you.
And Section 1 of the Senate bill and that provision is the same. Section 2 of the House bill provides for a subtraction from taxable income of contributions of food inventory. This allows S-corporations, partnerships, and sole proprietorships to permanently follow the rules that apply to C corporations under state taxes. Those rules have been applied on a temporary basis at the federal level to S corporations, partnerships, and sole proprietors, and then they've been extended periodically. And this section would just allow the pass-through entities that file through the individual income tax to claim the same deduction that's allowed for C corporations on an ongoing basis at the state level, regardless of what the federal government does to extend the allowance for the deduction. And the Senate doesn't have a comparable provision for that.
Ms. Pollack?
Mr. Chair and members, Section 2 of the Senate bill provides for subtractions from taxable income for military retirement pay. This begins in tax year 2011 with a 20% deduction of military retirement compensation received. It's phased in over 3 years, going next to 35% in 2012 and then 55% in 2013. And I don't believe the House has in a comparable section.
Ms. Manzi?
Section 3 of the House provides for a phased-in reduction in the individual income tax rates. There would be no change in tax year 11. In tax year 12, the current 5.35% rate would decrease to 5.25%, and the current 7.05% middle rate would decrease to 6.85%. The bottom rate would further decrease to 5.15% in tax year 13, and for tax year 14 and following years, the rates would be 4.75%, 6.75%, and then the top rate would remain unchanged at 7.85%. There's a table at the top of page 3 of the side-by-side that shows the taxable income ranges to which the middle and bottom rates apply in tax year 11, and that the Senate does not make changes to the individual income tax rates.
Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair, in Section 3 of the Senate bill provides for a tuition credit for K through 12 education expenses. The credit would be added to the list of other eligible expenses, and it equals 75% of qualifying expenses up to a maximum of $2,000, and it phases out at the $33,500 income level.
Ms. Manzi.
Mr. Chair, Section 4 of the House bill would increase the research credit, and there are two rates on the research credit. Under current law, it equals 10% of the first $2 million of expenses and 2.5% of research investment over $2 million. Those percentages would increase under this provision. In tax year 11, they would increase to 12.5% and 3.7%. And then the top rate would further increase to 5% in tax year 12, and then they would continue at 12.5% and 5% in beyond tax year 12. And there's no comparable provision to that in the Senate bill. Section 5 is the income tax reciprocity language. The first subdivision of this section eliminates the commissioner's authority to terminate a reciprocity agreement in effect with the state of Wisconsin and requires that any reciprocity agreement with Wisconsin must require estimated payments so that the net loss to the state of Minnesota as a result of reciprocity would have to be compensated in the same fiscal year in which the loss occurred. That would eliminate the time lag in payments that was one of the factors leading to the termination of the reciprocity agreement after tax year 2009. The second subdivision of this section directs the commissioner to begin negotiations with the state of Wisconsin with the objective of entering into a new reciprocity agreement. It does provide that the commissioner is not authorized to enter into a new agreement until Wisconsin has paid any amounts due under the old agreement with interest. And the Senate bill has a substantially similar language. There are a couple of sentences that are in a different order, I believe.
That's correct.
Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. Subdivision 1 of the Senate language is exactly the same, and then the order in which the language appears is flipped in Subdivision 2.
Thank you, Ms. Manzi.
Section 6 provides a corresponding subtraction under the alternative minimum tax for the subtraction allowed for contributions of food inventory that was provided in Section 2. This is necessary to keep affected taxpayers from shifting from the regular tax onto the alternative minimum tax as a result of claiming the subtraction for contributions of food inventory.
Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair, in Section 5 of the Senate bill, in order to compensate for the subtractions for military retirement pay in Section 2, the Senate bill provides a subtraction for the alternative minimum tax for the amounts deducted for military retirement pay. In Section 6 of the Senate bill, provides for a budget reserve fund checkoff so that an individual may designate when filing taxes an amount added to the tax liability or deducted from the refund for deposit into the budget reserve. And the House bill does not have a comparable provision. Sections 7 to 12 provide for a property estate tax exclusion for qualified small farm and businesses. The combined value of these deductions may not exceed $4 million, and the qualified property must be included in the federal adjusted taxable estate. And there are several qualifying factors. The decedent must have owned the property for 3 years immediately preceding death. A family member must use the property for qualified smart farm or small business purposes for 3 years immediately after the decedent's death. And recent gross annual sales may not have exceeded $10 million.
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, there's no comparable provision in the House bill. Section 7 of the House bill is the same as Section 13 of the Senate bill. These provide for a new income tax reciprocity benchmark study. This would allow the two states to gather new data on how many individuals there are who live in one state and earnings in the other state, and that would allow the states to appropriately set the amount of compensation from one state to the other. The study would be required to be completed and submitted to the legislature by March of 2013. It would be based on 2011 income tax returns, and presumably both states would modify the income tax forms for tax year 2011 to gather the data needed from individuals who live in one state but work in the other. Then there is an appropriation for the study. On the House side, it's in Article 9, Section 2, Subdivision 1. The appropriation is for $115,000 in fiscal year 12 and $215,000 in fiscal year 13. At the time that the House bill passed, we had not yet received a fiscal note from the Department of Revenue listing the estimated cost of the study. So that House appropriation, I believe, and Ms. Templin will verify this when she goes through the spreadsheet, but I believe the House appropriation matches the fiscal note that we had for a similar language from last session. The difference in cost from the fiscal note from last year to this year relates to the fact that now there is no longer a reciprocity agreement in effect with Wisconsin. So there would have to be some additional work by the two departments of revenue to gather the data necessary.
Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair, Section 13 of the Senate bill provides for the same income tax reciprocity study as the House bill. Section 14 provides for appropriations for that study, and I think the difference can be described by what Ms. Manzi mentioned. The Senate appropriates $409,000 in fiscal year 2012 and $429,000 in fiscal year 2013. Section 14 of the Senate bill also provides for appropriations for the administrative costs of administering the state budget reserve fund tax checkoff from Section 6, $104,000 in fiscal year 12 and $37,000 in fiscal year 13.
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to check with Ms. Pollack for just a moment on something.
Certainly.
We have a mistake. This is supposed to be made that mistake. So I'm sorry about that, but we should try to make that out.
Ms. Pollack?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Manzi just pointed out there's a typo in the side-by-side. On page 3 of Section 3 of the Senate bill, the K through 12 education credit, it should read up to a maximum of $1,000.
Okay. Members and staff, if you could just make that correction in your side-by-sides.
Mr. Chair, could she repeat that?
Okay. Senator Sengem, on page 3, under Section 3 on the Senate side, the K-12 education credit, go down to the third line from the bottom and change the 2 to a 1, so it's 1,000 instead of 2,000. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. And the revenue estimate, I believe, or the fiscal note for this reflects the $1,000 as opposed to the 2,000. That was just a typo in this.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Pollack.
I thought our position was getting better, Mr. Chair.
Okay, sales and use taxes. We have Pat Dalton, Ms. Dalton from the House side, and Ms. Pollack from the Senate side to go over these articles. Please proceed, Ms. Dalton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Starting with Section 1 of the House, Article 2, The House eliminates the accelerated remittance schedule for every month except for June. This is essentially eliminating the provisions that were enacted last year to deal with cash flow by accelerating sales tax remittances. And there is no comparable provision on the Senate side.
Ms. Pollack?
Mr. Chair, in the Senate file, sections 2 and 3 provides for a sales tax exemption for certain medical devices. These are durable medical equipment items that are covered by Medicare and Medicaid. It includes single patient use items. This provision brings the Minnesota sales tax exemption into compliance with the streamlined sales and use tax agreement. Section 4, House bill does not provide a comparable exemption. Section 4 of the Senate bill provides for sales tax exemption from the resale value of tickets, so only the resale value as opposed to the total face value and the resale value would receive an exemption, and the House provides no similar provision.
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just for a small clarification, Ms. Pollack is right regarding the medical equipment. This is in compliance with Streamline. Current law is also in compliance with Streamline. This is not a change necessary to get us into compliance. Section 2 of the House bill, ringtones, is one of the provisions that's necessary to bring us into compliance with Streamline sales tax. We have to remove the ringtones from the definition of taxable telecommunications, and both bills makes this change. Sections 3 and 4 are provisions that the Department of Revenue has brought forward related to compliance with Streamlined. It's not actually a change in law. It provides for a statutory language for how we deal with the transitional period when sales tax rates change. This is how the department currently administers it, but Streamline asks that it actually be put in the statute, and so that's why those provisions are there. And sections 5 and 6 relate to some changes that have been made in the Streamline definition of direct mail. They now have a separate definition for advertising and promotional material and other direct mail, and so the House has provisions to comply with those changes as well.
Thank you. Ms. Pollack?
Mr. Chair, the Senate has no comparable provisions. Do you want to move to the capital equipment?
Section 7 of the House bill relates to capital equipment. It removes the requirement for a refund for the sales tax to be paid at the time of purchase of capital equipment, and then a refund applied for, and this making capital equipment an upfront exemption would begin starting with fiscal year 2014. And there is no comparable Senate provision.
If I could just make a brief announcement, we're getting some interference with, there must be some cell phones that are on vibrate or something, so if we could maybe turn them off or so we can have a clear signal here. Who'd like to go next? Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair, sections 5 through 7 of the Senate bill provide for sales tax
Ms.
exemption.
Pollack, can you please turn your cell phone off? Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sections 5 through 7 provide for a sales tax exemption for townships. It's strikes language exempting sales to a town for gravel and machinery that's no longer needed under the more broad general exemption. And it also provides that if goods and services that are usually provided by a private business are taxable, those things would still continue under current law.
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Section 8 of the House bill relates to expanding the sales tax for local governments to include water used directly in providing fire protection by a fire department. This is a retroactive exemption. However, it is only retroactive if the tax has not already been paid.
Ms. Pollack?
Mr. Chair, the House or the Senate provides no comparable provision to the House's Section 8. In Sections 8 through 11 of the Senate bill, there's a sales tax exemption for purchases of public safety radios. The sales tax exemption would be effective January 2013, but qualifying sales and purchases between 2010 and 2012 are eligible for a sales tax refund after beginning January 2013.
Ms. Dalton?
The House has no comparable provision for the public safety radio exemption. Section 9 of the House removes the refund provisions for the capital equipment refunds, which effective beginning in fiscal year 14, and they won't be needed if we pass Section 7.
Ms. Pollack?
Mr. Chair, the Senate has no comparable provision. Section 12 of the Senate bill provides for a sales tax exemption for sale and purchase of certain small aircraft and aircraft repair and maintenance equipment.
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, the House has no comparable provision to Senate Section 12. The House Section 10 is a budgeted adjustment. It permanently reduces the Department of Revenue's annual budget by $140,000 a year related to the fact that the department will no longer need to process capital equipment. And Section 11 repeals the penalty and safe harbor provisions related to the early remittances of sales taxes in all the other months except June. That occurred in Section 1 of the House bill.
Thank you. Now to Article 3. Thank you, Ms. Dalton, and thank you, Ms. Pollack. Welcome to the committee. If you could both state your names and who you represent for the record, please.
Joel Michael from House Research.
I'm Joanne Zoff from Senate Counsel.
Welcome to the conference committee. Let's start with Mr. Michael.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Article 3 is the economic development article. The first 10 sections establish this Minnesota Science and Technology Program. The Senate does not have a comparable provision. Section 2 of the article is the definition section. The authority that will be administering this program is the Minnesota Science and Technology Authority, which is an existing authority, I think consisting of several commissioners. I'm not sure exactly which they are, but I know the commissioner of deed and several others are on that. Other terms that are defined are colleges and university, which is a private or public higher education institution in Minnesota. Commercialization are activities that essentially develop and produce a new product. Commercialized research project, research conducted at a college or university or nonprofit in Minnesota. Fund is the Science and Technology Fund, which is created by Section 3. Nonprofit research institution and also qualified science and technology companies are defined. The companies have to be Minnesota businesses with 100 or fewer employees that are engaged in sort of science and technology-related activities. Section 3 establishes the fund that's a special revenue fund that will finance the various activities of the authority. And this is funded with a standing appropriation that in the coming fiscal year is a $1.5 million per year standing appropriation. And that increases in the next and following biennium to $3.5 million per year. Section 4 sets forth the authorized uses that that fund can be put to. There are four different programs that are detailed in later sections: the Commercialized Research Program, Federal Research and Development, Industry Innovation and Competitiveness Program, and then a general authority to carry out the powers of the authority in making grants and loans. Section 5 describes the Commercialized Research Program, and again, this is an instance where you're taking, developing a new product to be produced relating to basic research. The program is authorized to provide up to $250,000 per project grants for these kinds of activities. Before doing it, they have to, set up written criteria that will govern the awards and that apply to the recipients, which are either colleges and universities or nonprofit institutions. Section 6 sets out the parameters for the Federal Research and Development Support Program and authorizes the authority to essentially fund these programs. The authority is supposed to identify potential federal money to tap for this and then can make grants to either companies. This is only for businesses, so the grants have to be to companies, and there's a matching requirement. Section 7 outlines or establishes the requirements for the Industry Innovation and Competitiveness Program, and again, this is a matching grant program, and it's intended to retain scientific and engineering and technical jobs in Minnesota. Again, there are requirements that the authority, before it makes these grants, has to set out the criteria for them and so forth. And again, it's a matching grant. There's a matching requirement by the recipient. Section 8 lays out the general powers of the Science and Technology Authority, which is the usual set of powers that are granted to these types of governmental entities. There is a limit put on the amount of the funding that can be used for administrative expenses, which is 5% of the first $5 million in the fund and then 2% of the amount that's over that. The authority is directed to set priorities as to how they allocate their money for grants, and there's a list of the priorities that they're supposed to consider: collaboration with private businesses and so forth. Section 9 is a repayment requirement for a recipient of one of these awards, either a grant, loan, or so forth. If they essentially move out of the state within 2 years, they have to repay the entire amount. If they relocate or cease operations between 2 and 3 years, then 75% of that has to be repaid. Section 10 provides that the law expires at the same time that the existing Science and Technology Authority expires, which is June 30 of 2018. If there's any money left in the fund at that point, it would go back to the general fund.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. Ms. Zoff?
And Mr. Chair and members, that provision is not addressed in the Senate article. The first two sections of the Senate article, which focuses exclusively on tax increment financing provisions, the first two sections both modify provisions that were part of the 2010 jobs bill that had provided some broad authorization for expenditures of tax increments to provide loans or other subsidies or assistance to developments that would consist of buildings or ancillary facilities if the municipality found that the project would create or retain jobs in the state, including construction jobs, and that the construction of the project would not have commenced before the deadline that was in that bill, which was July 1st, 2011, without this assistance. The first section of Article 5 of the Senate bill extends the date from July 1st, 2011, specifically for expenditures of increments from economic development districts, extends that by 1 year, except that that extension would not apply to housing projects. The second section of Article 5 in the Senate bill
provides a general authorization for the extension of these kinds of expenditures. The provision that's amended in Section 2 also authorized expenditures of increments to make an investment in a business that the authority would determine would be necessary to make the type of construction that was authorized in the bill feasible. That was all current law. The effect of these first two sections is to extend those deadlines for an additional year, except with respect to housing projects. And there's no comparable provision on the House side.
Thank you, Mr. Michael.
Section 11 of the House bill relates to tax increment financing. This modifies the special authority that exists in current law with regard to the pooling for housing. Pooling, just to refresh people's memory, is the authority that allows the development authorities or cities to use revenues from one district for activities outside of the district. And there are percentage restrictions on that. The law says that you can take up to 10%, 10 percentage points above that and use it for housing purposes. Under current law, those amounts are restricted to affordable housing. In other words, that meets income and rent or value restrictions for owner-occupied housing. The provisions in Section 11 of the House bill changes the rules that relate to that additional 10% for housing and allows it to be used for certain kinds of market rate housings that don't, that does not meet the affordable rules under current law. And basically what that's permitted to do is that you could use it for owner-occupied housing with a value up to 150% of the average market value of housing in the city, but that can exceed $200,000 in the metro area or $125,000 in the rest of the state. And this money could be used to essentially acquire housing, demolish it, redevelop it for site preparation and pollution cleanup for housing that's either been vacant for 6 months, that's structurally substandard, that's in foreclosure, or is an adjacent or adjoining parcel that you need in order to develop one of those other types of housing that I just went through. And this is subject to a 6-year or a 5-year from now sunset at the end of 2016. Senate does not have a comparable provision. Section 12 is special authority for the city of Ramsey, which was a special law was enacted for the city of Ramsey in the 2010 omnibus tax bill. This provision makes a correction in that law. The boundary was not accurately defined in the law. This adds an eastern boundary to the district. In addition, it makes three other changes. First of all, it allows up to 90, it essentially allows this district to not be subject to the 90% restriction on the use of redevelopment district increments. Under general law, 90% of the increments from a redevelopment district must be used for essentially blight correction activities. This district would be, under the House provision, exempt from that requirement. Secondly, this provision also allows increments to be used to pay for land that was acquired by the city before the TIF district was created and for public improvements that were paid for or that were begun and that were put in place before the district. The third additional special authority for this district is that the 4-year knockdown rule would be extended to 6 years. The 4-year rule essentially says that there has to be activity on the parcel or adjacent to the parcel, for example, installing public improvements or, you know, constructing a building or something of that nature in order for the parcel to remain in the district. And the House provision would extend that to 6 years.
Mr. Chair, members, the Senate has a provision relating to the Ramsey TIF district, but the only change that is made is to make the same boundary correction that is included in the House bill. The other extensions of authorizations are not included on the Senate side.
Thank you. Mr. Michael?
Section 13 is special tax increment financing authority for the city of Lino Lakes. And what it does is essentially allow the city of Lino Lakes to extend by 10 years an economic development tax increment district, district number 1-10. And then if it elects to do that, it can use the increments that result from that extension for two purposes: to pay debt services on bonds that were issued to finance improvements in connection with the County Road 23 interchange with I-35W, and costs that the city has incurred related to the legacy at Woods Edge development. And those expenditures would be exempt from the general restrictions on pooling and the five-year rule and the percentage limits and so forth.
And the Senate has the identical provision in its article.
Mr. Chairman, Section 14 of the House bill grants the City of Taylor's Falls the authority to establish a border city development zone. These zones, under current law, are all along the western border. Each of the cities that have regular border city enterprise zones have these zones, so that's Moorhead, Dilworth, Breckenridge, East Grand Forks, and Ortonville. In a special law passed in 2001, the city of Laverne was also granted one of the authority to establish one of these districts. The bill allocates $100,000 to the city to use for purposes of this district, and essentially what that allows is the city can use that $100,000 to grant either corporate income, corporate franchise tax reductions, sales tax reductions, or property tax reductions to businesses that are located in these border city development zones.
Ms. Zoff?
Mr. Chairman, the Senate did not include the Taylor's Falls provision in its article. We do have Section 4, which relates to the city of Cohasset. There are two tax increment financing districts in that city that would be authorized to transfer increments to the city to compensate the city for expenditures that it had made that would have been eligible to be made under the tax increment financing law. The city had advanced these costs to the districts, and this would enable the increments to be used to reimburse the city for those expenses.
Mr. Chairman, Section 15 is an appropriation section. What this really does is to redirect some of the standing appropriation for the Science and Technology Authority that was in Section 3 of the article. If you'll recall, that had a $1.5 million per year appropriation, so there's a $3 million appropriation for the biennium. What this section does is to essentially take away $200,000 of that from the authority for fiscal 12 and give it to the Enterprise Minnesota program, and $475,000 of that for fiscal 13 and appropriate that to the Biobusiness Alliance. So those amounts would, that $675,000 would reduce the $3 million that's available to the Science and Technology Authority. An additional $50,000 is also taken from that appropriation and appropriated to the Minnesota Inventors. The final provision of this section essentially allows a $107,000 exemption from that percentage cap on their administrative expenses, which, if you recall, was 5% of the first $5 million that was in the fund. And this would essentially allow, on a one-time basis for fiscal 13, an additional $107,000 for administrative expenses.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Michael and Ms. Zoff. We'll go to Article 4, local taxes, Senate Article 2, sales taxes. And we will have Ms. Dalton and Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair, starting with House Article 4, Section 1. Section 1 does two things. It reinstates a provision that had expired on May 31st, 2010, that prohibits a local government from holding a referendum to impose a local sales tax unless it is for an existing tax or for a tax authorized by special law prior to the end of this legislative session. And this new limit would be effective for another 2 years until May 31st, 2013. The second thing this section does is it prohibits a local government from spending money on a local sales tax referendum other than the actual holding the election. So it can't spend money to either promote or oppose the tax. And that's effective the day after final enactment and would apply to all sales tax referendum for local sales taxes authorized in this article.
Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair and members, the Senate's local sales taxes were included in the Article 2 under all sales taxes. Section 13 of the Senate file strikes language that refers to the prohibition on authorizing new sales taxes until 2010. Since that date has passed, the section was no longer needed. In Section 14 of the Senate file, requires voter approval of a local option sales tax before it may be authorized by the legislature, and this is intended to be effective prospectively. And it also adds clarifying language so that a referendum on the issuance of bonds to be paid from the proceeds of a local sales tax don't have to include notice of property tax increase, and that they're not subject to property offset by property tax values in that local subdivision.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, the House has no similar provision to the Senate Section 14. Section 2 of the House relates to an aggregate materials tax for the city of Glenwood Township. Basically, if the County of Pope does not impose a gravel tax, Glenwood Township would be allowed to impose the tax in the township instead. Proceeds of the tax must be used for the same purpose as the county tax would be used for, and the township tax would be repealed if Pope County started to impose a gravel tax. There is no comparable provision on the Senate side. Sections 3 and 4 of the House side relate to the Hennepin County ballpark tax. It reduces the 1.5% escalator that applies to the $4 million limit on money that may be used for library hours and youth activities and sports. It basically reduces this to 0.75% and allows the growth to only be used in the libraries. So the amount that can be spent for youth activities and sports is limited to $2 million a year. The other thing it does is imposes a $20 million limit on the amount of reserves that may be maintained for the baseball park and prohibits maintaining any type of reserve for the purpose of making library and youth activity and sports grants. So when this cap of $20 million on the reserve is reached, all additional monies must be used to redeem or defease the bonds, hopefully ending the tax a little earlier.
Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair and members, the Senate has no comparable provision.
Ms. Dahl, why don't you continue with 5?
Section 5, City of Hermantown authorizes them to increase their local sales tax from the current 0.5% to the originally authorized 1% if approved by the voters at a general election held by the end of calendar year 2012. The only difference between the House and Senate is that the Senate allows it to be held at a special election or a general election, and the House requires the general election. Sections 6, 7, and 8 relate to an extension of the sales and use tax in the city of Rochester. The House essentially allows an extension for up to an additional $101.5 million of projects $47 million for transportation projects, $26.5 million for higher education, $8 million for regional public safety facilities, and $20 million for the Destination Medical Community Initiative.
Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair and members, Section 16 of the Senate bill is similar. It allows an additional $58.5 million for a total of $160 million for the expansion, $40.5 million going to regional youth and elder community facilities, and $38 million for economic development purposes. And this $38 million includes the $20 million in the comparable House position.
Ms. Dalton?
Section 9 of the House bill is a expands the authorized uses of the Clearwater sales tax to include improvements to regional parks, bicycle trails, parkland, and open space included in the city's 2006 improvement plan. These projects were originally included in the city's original 2008 request but were left out of the authorization in 2008 because they hadn't been tied to a specific plan. They came in with a specific plan, and so that's why it's here now. And both the House and the Senate had that provision. Section 10 allows the city of Cloquet to impose a half-cent sales tax based on approval at a general election. They may also impose the flat $20 per vehicle tax on vehicles sold by dealers located in the city. The revenues are $4.5 million for various park improvements, $5.8 million for extensions of utilities, and other development adjacent to Highway 33 and Interstate 35, and $6.2 million related to infrastructure improvements identified in the city's comprehensive plan. It allows $16.5 million in bonds to be issued, and the tax expires at the earlier of 30 years or when revenues are sufficient to make the bond payments.
Mr. Ms. Chair, Pollack. The Senate has no comparable provision.
Ms. Dalton.
Section 11 is the sales tax for the city of Fergus Falls, allows them to impose a 1/2 cent sales tax to fund a regional ice arena. This arena has the imposition of this tax for this arena has already been approved by the voters at the 2010 general election, and it allows the city to use up to $6.6 million in revenues to pay the costs of essentially the ice facility, and the tax expires when the revenues are sufficient to pay for the project and retire the associated bonds.
Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair, the Senate provision is the same.
Ms. Dalton.
Section 12 is the sales tax for the city of Hutchinson. It's a 1/2 cent sales tax to pay for its wastewater treatment facility. Again, this one has already been approved by the voters at the 2010 general election. It also includes the $20 per vehicle flat tax, and the revenues are used to pay for the construction and renovation of the city's wastewater treatment facility. It expires at the earlier of 18 years or when the revenues are sufficient to pay off the project.
Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair, the Senate's provision is the same.
Ms. Dalton.
Section 13 is the sales tax for the city of Lanesboro. Again, it's a 1/2 cent sales tax. And this tax has been approved by the voters at the 2010 general election. It is for the revenues that may be raised are $800,000 plus associated bond costs, and it's for various street improvements, street lighting, wastewater treatment facilities, utility improvements, the Lanesboro High Hazard Dam, and improvements to the community center library and city hall.
Ms. Pollack?
Mr. Chair, the Senate's provision is the same.
Ms. Dalton?
Section 14, the City of Marshall is allowed to impose a 1/2 cent sales tax if approved by the voters at a general election held in the next 2 years. And the city, the tax is for two different projects, the Minnesota Emergency Response and Industry Training Center and the Southwest Minnesota Regional Amateur Sports Center. The bill requires that the city actually have two separate ballot questions, one for each of the projects. And then allows the city to issue up to $17.29 million in bonds for the two projects. And the tax expires at the earlier of 15 years or when revenues are sufficient to pay for the projects.
Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair, the Senate does not have a comparable provision for the City of Marshall.
Ms. Dalton.
Section 15, the City of Medford is allowed to have impose a half-cent sales tax to repay the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority loans for its wastewater treatment systems. If approved by the voters at a general election, the tax is allowed to raise $4.2 million to pay off the bonds, and it expires at the earlier of 20 years or when the revenues are sufficient. And to save Ms. Pollack, the Senate has no comparable provision. And the final provision in this article in the House is a study. Section 16 is a study looking at the use of zip codes in collecting local sales taxes. There have been some issues raised about taxes being collected in townships that share zip codes with cities that impose a local sales tax. And then there's also been some issues raised with whether taxes are being accurately collected and remitted to the correct city when there are some cities who share zip codes and but they're contiguous and they have different sales taxes. And this has occurred up in northeast Minnesota. And so that's what the study is. And the study is funded in a later article of the bill.
Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair, the Senate does not have a comparable provision.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Dalton. Ms. Pollack, we'll move on to Article 5, property taxes. That's in the House. The Senate's Article 4, property taxes. We have Mr. Hines and Ms. Zoff. And Ms. Dalton. Mr. Hines, if you could please start us off, please.
Mr. Chairman, House Section 1 is a technical provision relating to some other language in Section 4. I think I'll discuss it a little more when we get to Section 4.
Okay. Ms. Zoff.
Mr. Chairman, Section 1 of the property tax article in the Senate bill extends for 2 years, from 8 to 10 years, the period of time during which a political subdivision can hold property for later economic development purposes, so that during that period of time, that property would be exempt from taxation.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, House Section 2 is a exemption for attached machinery for a electric generation facility proposed to be built in the city of Fairmont.
Ms. Zoff.
And Mr. Chair, the Senate provision is identical. Section 3 of the Senate article provides that if an assessor denies an application for Green Acres treatment, the applicant may appeal that decision to the local Board of Appeal and Equalization.
Mr. Hines.
House Section 3 provides for on evaluation notice for a specific notification be made when the property has been changed in classification from the previous year to a more obvious flag of that fact having occurred.
Ms. Zoff.
The Senate has no provision on that.
Mr. Hines.
House Section 4 provides a property tax reduced classification for small inns located on seasonal, so they're used less than 250 days a year, that are located in a city outside the metropolitan area with a population under 2,500 containing a state trail. And then there's also some cleanup and some recodification language a little bit in that Section 4, and that relates to the change in Section 1, which separates the treatment of how the statutory classification for commercial and non-commercial seasonal recreational property.
Ms. Zoff?
Mr. Chairman, the Senate does not include that provision in its article. Section 7 of the Senate property tax article modifies the preferential class rate that applies to some nonprofit community service organizations so that they're able to count the expenditures that they make to replace their own buildings for up to 50% of the charitable contributions that they're required to make during the year to obtain a reduced class rate. This would be available for up to 20 years. This is a provision in the lawful gambling law that allows expenditures by these organizations to replace a building that had been destroyed by a fire or some other catastrophe or that was taken by eminent domain if the organization wasn't compensated for that.
Mr. Hines?
Section 5 provides a number of expansions of the current market value exclusion for disabled veterans property. The first expansion is that the currently surviving spouses of a disabled veteran get the benefit for approximately 2 years after the disabled veteran passes, and this would extend that to 5 full years. Then the next provision extends this by adding surviving spouses of a service member who's killed in action, that a surviving spouse there would become eligible for this same market value exclusion for a period of 5 years. And then the third expansion is that a new category of qualifiers is a disabled veteran's primary family caregiver, which relates to a new program created at the federal level. This primary family caregiver could receive the exclusion if the veteran, him or herself, did not actually own a homestead.
Ms. Zoff?
Mr. Chairman, the Senate article includes the same provision but only makes the changes relating to the extension of the time period for the surviving spouses in the same manner as the House. The Senate provision does not relate to surviving spouses of the members who die while in active service or to the primary family caregivers. And then on the Senate side, Section 9 is related to the earlier provision dealing with Green Acres, appeals of Green Acres denials. Section 9 would authorize the local boards of review to take these appeals. If they choose to do this, they would have to pass a resolution stating that they will. And then if they do choose to exercise this authority, they have to review all the denials that come before them until such time as they pass a resolution saying they're no longer going to be doing these reviews.
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, Section 6 deals with the state general levy, and in the House, the state general levy is reduced for commercial industrial properties reduced by $32.1 million per year, effective for payable 2012 and thereafter. The general levy for seasonal recreational property is not changed.
Mr. Chairman, Section 10 of the Senate article phases out the state general levy for both commercial, industrial, and seasonal recreational property. The state general levy is reduced by approximately 9% for the first 2 years, that is for taxes payable in 2012 and 2013, and then for 2014 and 15 by 5% each year, and then by 10% of the payable 2013 level for all succeeding taxable years until the tax is actually eliminated after taxes payable in 2024.
Mr. Hines?
Section 7 is a technical change related to this minor recodification that occurred in Section 4 on seasonal recreational property. Section 8 is a technical provision related to the Section 6, the change in the state general tax, and it just sort of eliminates the apportionment of the state general levy 95%, 5% between commercial and seasonal, since now each of the two types has a specific amount set. There's no longer that section is no longer needed.
And Mr. Chair, Section 11 of the Senate article does the same function with respect to the state general levy, but related to our different kind of a phase out and elimination.
Mr. Hines? Or Ms. Dahl?
Mr. Chairman, Section 9 is a it strikes the regional rail authorities from the statute that lists the different types of special taxing districts. And a little further down, and later on in the section, or in the article, we have some sections that deal with the regional rail authorities. I'll explain that a little more then.
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, there is no comparable provision for the Senate on the special taxing districts. For the House, sections 10 through 13 relate to extending the current special levy limit law for another 2 years to taxes payable in 2012 and 2013. Section 10 also eliminates the special levy for market value credit reimbursement reductions beginning with taxes payable in 2013. This is because the bill eliminates market value credit reductions in the next article, and there is no comparable provision on the Senate side. Section 14 on the House basically suspends the maintenance of effort requirements for counties for calendar years 2012 and 2013, provided that the suspension of an MOE does not require the state to spend additional money or causes the state or county to lose federal funds. And it also exempts cities from the library MOE for 2012 and 2013. And the Commissioner of Management and Budget is required to post a list of all MOEs that will be suspended under this provision.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Article 3, Section 14 of the Senate provision reduces the county maintenance of effort requirements for regional libraries, mental health services, child welfare, targeted case management, and family service collaboratives to 90% of the amount that was required for 2011. And this provision will be in effect for 2012 and 2013. The maintenance of effort reductions can't result in any increased state costs or a reduction in federal funding. And then the city maintenance of effort requirement for regional libraries is also reduced to 90% of its current level for the next 2 years.
Mr. Hines?
Section 15 is a provision that affects relates to late payment of property taxes, and it provides that all classes of property would be subject to the schedule of penalties that currently applies to homestead property. So it basically gives the more lenient homestead schedule to commercial industrial properties and all other types of property. Sections, and then there's no comparable provision on the Senate on that one. Sections 16 and 17 are eliminate the regional rail authorities as a separate entity in state government and transfer the authority for the regional rail levies and bonding to the county itself. So the county government would be which generally functions as the regional rail authority, the county board, now transfers that function so that the county board would actually be responsible for setting levies related to regional rail function. And Section 17 requires that the county make levies for debt issued by the regional rail authority prior to this, prior to the effective date of this act.
And the Senate has no comparable provisions on those.
And Section 18, the repealer, repeals some language related to, again, late payment language related to the change in Section 15 on seasonal recreational property.
And, Mr. Chair, the Senate does not have the same repealer, but it does repeal the law establishing the state general levy for taxes payable in 2024 and thereafter.
Okay, to Article 6 in the House, Article 3 in the Senate. Thank you, Ms. Off. Okay, let's start with Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Article 6, Sections 1 and 2 are related to a number of sections throughout the article, and they're related to reducing the per-acre pill payments for all the various natural resource lands, and Article Section 1 is for the public hunting lands, reducing it by 15% to 85% of current levels, and Section 2 is for the goose management crop lands, and again, it's to reduce the payment to 85% of current levels.
Mr. Paulson.
Mr. Chair, Jack Paulson from Senate Council and Research. The Senate Sections 1 and 2 are similar, except that the Senate has a 12% reduction in PILT payments. So the 0.75% goes to 0.6% on the public hunting lands. And similarly in Section 2, it's to 88% rather than 85%.
Ms. Dahl, can you tell us about goose management?
Mr. Chair, Section 3, which is the same in both bills, strikes a reference to the political contribution refund, which is repealed later on in the article.
Oh, excuse me, did we miss goose management? Oh, that's part of one. Okay, thank you very much. Very important provision. Okay, can you redo the PCR?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Section 3, which is the same in both articles, strikes a reference to the political contribution refund. This refund, political contribution refund, is repealed in both bills in a later section.
Okay, thank you. Section 4. Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Section 4 provides that the current market value homestead credit is to be converted to a reduction in the property's tax capacity effective for 2012 and thereafter.
Mr. Paulson.
Mr. Chair, the Senate Section 4 has the same provision.
Okay, Mr. Paulson.
Mr. Chair, Section 5, the property tax classification for managed forest land currently has a cross-reference to the definition of forest management plan that's in the sustainable forest land section that is being repealed under the bill, so it's just a matter of copying that definition into the managed forest land section of the statute.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, Section 5 is related to this change in Section 4, which changed the market value credit to a tax capacity reduction. And that is also the same in the Senate. Then Section 6 is a similar section. This is related to the portion that calls for the state to pay the market value homestead credit, and it's stricken as a state payment. The summary points out that the agricultural market value credit continues to be a state payment, but no longer the market value credit. The homestead market value credit no longer is. And Section 7 is the same, related to the same fact, and those are the same in the Senate bill as well. Section 8, there's a list in statute of the various credits that are taken from the property tax and going from its gross tax to its net tax. It strikes that market value homestead credit from that list of credits.
Mr. Paulson?
Mr. Chair, the Senate has the same provision in our Section 10.
Okay.
And then,
Mr. Hines?
Chairman, Section 9 makes two different changes, or I guess just one. In the disparity reduction aid, the House provides for a across-the-board 50% reduction in disparity reduction aid of the certified 2011 amount for 2012 going forward. And it also eliminates the provision in law that provided that the disparity reduction aid would be recalculated every time there was a change in class rates.
Mr. Paulson?
Mr. Chair, the Senate takes a different approach on disparity reduction aid. The Senate eliminates disparity reduction aid for counties and townships beginning in payable 2012, but school districts will continue to receive the amount that they got in payable 2011 in all subsequent years. The Senate also deletes the recalculation for tax capacity changes.
Okay, Mr. Paulson.
And Mr. Chair, the disparity reduction credit, the Senate phases out over 4 years, beginning with taxes payable in 2012.
Okay, Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Section 10 is another kind of technical section related to the change to the from the market to the tax capacity reduction discussed earlier. Section 11 is another section, change in disparity reduction aid, and this currently there's a provision that says disparity reduction aid cannot cause a jurisdiction or an area's tax capacity rate to go below 90%. This provision raises that threshold to 105% of tax capacity, so you couldn't receive disparity aid that would reduce your tax rate below 105%.
Mr. Paulson?
Mr. Chair, the Senate did not include that provision on disparity reduction.
Okay, Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, Section 12 is another section relating to the elimination of the market value homestead credit.
Mr. Paulson?
Mr. Chair, the Senate has the same provision as the House on Sections 12, 13, and 14.
And Mr. Hines.
Chairman, Sections 13 and 14 relate to the elimination of the political contribution refund, as Dalton mentioned earlier. Section 15 is a change in the rent constituting property taxes for the property tax refund program. In the House, reduces the percentage of rent paid from 19% to 12% for claims filed in 2011 and thereafter, based on rent paid in 2010 and thereafter.
Mr. Paulson?
And Mr. Chair, the Senate Section 18 reduces the percent of rent constituting property taxes from 19% to 15% effective at the same time.
Mr. Paulson?
Mr. Chairman, Section 16 is the same provision reducing the percentage of rent from 19% to 12%, but just the Section 16 relates to manufactured homes.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Paulson?
And Mr. Chair, again, the Senate provision is similar, but the percentage reduction is from 19% to 15% of manufactured homes.
Thank you. Mr. Paulson?
Mr. Chair, Sections 21 and 21 of the Senate relate to the homeowner property tax refund, and the Senate increases the maximum state refund and reduce the percentage paid by claimants at most income levels, the household income levels are updated to reflect inflation adjustments through the 2012 filing year. It's effective for refunds based on taxes payable in 2012 and following years.
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, the House has no comparable provision to the homeowner PTR changes.
Ms. Dalton?
Section 17 of the House bill allows an alternative process for consolidation. Currently, counties may only consolidate if they have a petition signed by 25% of the voters in the last general election for each county in order to start the process. And this allows them to, if each county board files a unanimous resolution, they may, with the Secretary of State, they may start the consolidation process.
Mr. Paulson?
Mr. Chair, the Senate has no comparable provision.
Ms. Dalton?
Section 18 is a definition of first-class city. It's based on the population in 2008. So the cities who qualify as first-class cities under this definition are Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth. And this definition is used in the local government aid reductions that I will talk about shortly.
Mr. Paulson?
Mr. Chair, the Senate has no comparable provision.
Okay, Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Section 19 provides for reductions in county program aid for 2011 and 2012 and provides that the county program aid will be equal to the lesser of the amount actually received in 2010 or the amount certified to be received in 2011. It's an overall reduction from $197 million to $161 million.
Mr. Paulson?
Mr. Chair, the Senate provision in Section 22 is the same.
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to talk about Sections 20 through 22 together. These all relate to the local government aid reductions for cities, and I will start actually with Section 22, the aid payments in 2011 and 2012. In pay 2011, under the House provision, first-class cities will receive 75% of their base aid, which is the amount, the lesser of the amount they were certified to receive in 2011 or the amount they were actually paid in 2010. All the remaining cities will receive their certified 2011 amount. They will have no cut in pay 2011. In pay 2012, first-class cities will receive 50% of that base aid amount, and the remaining cities will receive 100% of that base aid amount, which, as I said, was the lesser of what they were paid in 2010 or what they're certified to get in 2011, which is essentially what was proposed in the House File 130 bill that was later repealed. The Section 20 of the bill continues the phase-out of local government aid to first-class cities that was begun in Section 22. Those cities get 25% of their base aid in pay 2013 and are zeroed out in pay 2014 and thereafter. And Section 21 does two things. It clarifies the starting point for calculating maximum aid increases and decreases beginning in pay 2011, and it states that these limits on increases and decreases do not apply to the first to the changes in the first class cities.
Mr. Paulson.
Mr. Chair, starting across from House Section 20, the Senate does not have the provision relating to the first class cities. So there's no comparable provision. Section 21, the Senate is similar with regard to the way that the minimum and maximum aids will be starting in 2013, but again, not the provision related to the first-class cities. On the next page, Senate Section 24, the Senate adopted the provisions that were in House File 130, the Conference Committee report in this section. So aid to all cities is the lesser of 2011 certified LGA or the final 2010 aid payment. That applies to both 2011 and 2012. The Senate did include the language related to the city of Houston that was in the House File 130 Conference Committee report. That's it. That's Senate Section 24.
Okay. 23. Ms. Dalton.
Section 23 relates to the appropriation, the ongoing appropriations for city and county aid programs. For cities under the House bill, the LGA appropriation for pay 2013 and 2014 and thereafter reflect the remaining phase out of LGA to the first class cities. The appropriation is $274.3 million in pay 2014 thereafter, and that is equal to the amount of aid going to cities other than the first class cities in pay 2012. So basically we're taking the appropriation down to that level. Beginning in 2013, that money will be distributed via the formula that's in current law.
Mr. Paulson.
Mr. Chair, in Senate Section 25, the LG appropriation for cities is reduced from $527 million to $426.4 million. And that's it's holding the funding level constant going forward for LGA. And the same for county program aid. It's being reduced from $197.7 to $165.7 million going forward beginning in 2013. Those were the Senate provisions that were in this. The Senate position for House File 130 that ended up not being adopted.
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, just point out, I was going to talk about the county provision in Section 23. There is a typo on the paragraph relating to cities, which relates to what says that references first-class cities and suburbs, and that and suburbs reference should be stricken in that.
Okay. Mr. Hines, where is that again?
And for House Section 23, the first paragraph in the bill, this is in the bill summary, the side-by-side, excuse me, there's a reference to in the last sentence to first-class cities and suburbs, and that and suburbs should be stricken.
Okay, members, if you could please strike and suburbs.
Yeah. Okay. There's no suburbs are not being treated differently than any other cities.
Okay.
The bottom line there.
Mr. Hines?
As far as counties, for counties, the county program aid appropriation for 2013 and thereafter is set at the $161 million level, as under Section 19 for payable 2011 and 2012, but starting in 2013, the amount would be distributed through the formula once again.
Mr. Paulson?
Mr. Chair, the in Senate Section 25, the county program aid appropriation is reduced from 197.7 to 165.7 million beginning in 2013, and it's also going to be distributed through the formula.
Ms. Dalton?
Sections 24 through 27 on the House side all relate to the reduction in the pill payments. Section 24 eliminates the inflation factor for pill payments, which is repealed. It eliminates a cross-reference to it because the inflation factor is repealed in Section 32. That's the same on the Senate side. Sections 25, 26, and 27 are reducing current payments from to 85% of what current law is. And Section 25 also adjusts the payments from the county to the townships and into the various funds by a proportional amount.
Mr. Paulson?
Mr. Chair, Senate Sections 27 through 29 are similar to the House provisions relating to PILT, but once again, the appropriation is reduced by 12% rather than 15% in the House.
Thank you. Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, Section 28 directs the Commissioner of Revenue to recalculate 2011 property tax renter property tax refund claims to reflect the change in the percentage of rent paid assumption from 19% to 12%, and to notify claimants that the recalculated refunds are the result of action of the 2011 legislature.
Mr. Paulson?
Mr. Chair, Senate Section 30 is similar, but with the same direction of the Commissioner of Revenue and the notification to claimants, but the Senate percent change again is from 19% to 15%.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, Section 29 reduces county and city paid 2011 market value credit reimbursements to the same amount that they received in payable 2010 after reductions. Again, this is the same provision that was in the House File 130 legislation that was passed earlier and vetoed by the governor.
Mr. Paulson?
Mr. Chair, the Senate has the same provision in substance, but it's drafted differently. It's codified. But other than that, the provisions are the same.
Mr. Hines?
Section 30 provides that for the on the 2012 property tax statement that the property tax statement will reflect the market value credit in payable in 2011 as a reduction in the gross tax and will not show it separately as a market value credit reduction.
Mr. Paulson?
And Mr. Chair, the Senate in Section 31 has the same provision.
Mr. Paulson?
Senate Section 32 is a study of the payment in lieu of tax program, and it requires the Commissioner of Natural Resources to report to the legislature with recommended changes to the PILT program. There's a requirement to consult with the Commissioner of Revenue and Management and Budget stakeholders. It's required to include an analysis of the current PILT payment system and any recommended changes to the criteria, the rate of payments, classes of natural resources, land, the distribution formula, and also to the recognition of tax capacity foregone due to the loss of future development potential for the land.
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, the House has no comparable provision to the department to the Senate's PILT study. Section 31 in the House bill provides for cooperation, consolidation, and innovation grants. It allows the Commissioner of Administration to make grants of up to $100,000 to local governments to plan and implement service cooperation and consolidation or innovation, provided that they are working with at least one other local government. Grants are on a first-come, first-served basis, and the appropriation is $1.6 million per year for the fiscal year 2012-2013 biennium.
Mr. Paulson?
Mr. Chair, the Senate has a similar grant program. It's for consolidation and service sharing grants. It doesn't specifically mention innovation. It's administered by the state auditor instead of the Commissioner of Administration. And the Senate appropriates $3.5 million in each of fiscal years 2012 and 2013.
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, then the repealer, Section 32 in the House bill, includes a number of provisions. Paragraphs A and B are actually eliminate the political contribution refund. Paragraph C repeals the market value credit reimbursement reduction for towns in 2011. And also eliminates the inflation factor for PILT payments. And then paragraph D repeals the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act program effective July 1 of 2011 and requires the Commissioner of Revenue to issue a document to each enrollee in Sustainable Forest program releasing the land from the covenant agreement.
Mr. Paulson?
Mr. Chair, Senate Section 34 has the same provision in paragraphs A and B relating to the repeal of the political contribution refund program. The Senate paragraph D of Section 34 repeals the market value credit reimbursement reduction for towns, but for payable 2012, not for payable 2011. We have the same provision in paragraph C repealing the PILT inflation factor. Our Sustainable Forest Incentive Act repealer is the same in paragraph F of the Senate section. We have a couple of additional repealer provisions. One is that paragraph C also repeals a wetland reimbursement in addition to the PILT inflation factor. And Senate paragraph E repeals the disparity reduction credit, and that's effective for taxes payable in 2015 after the four-year phase-out.
Thank you, Mr. Paulson. And now we'll go to Article 7, Green Acres and Rural Preserves.
Mr.
Hines?
Chairman, this is the same as House File 12, or the same materials that were covered. I didn't know if you wanted to go through that or not.
I don't really know. What do members think? I don't really know if we need to. It's going to be heard in the Senate today. I believe it's already passed the House. I think we'll walk through it if we need to. If it becomes law, then it's really unnecessary to walk through it here. So let's skip through Article 7. Let's go to Article 8, Minerals in the House. Article 6 in the Senate, the Minerals Provisions. We'll have Mr. Michael and Ms. Zoff. And let's start with the Senate here. Let's start with Ms. Zoff.
Mr. Chair, Article 6 of the Senate bill is the minerals article. A number of these sections have to do with clarifying the application of the taxes to non-ferrous mining activities. Section 1 clarifies that businesses that conduct mining, producing or refining of ores, as well as metals and minerals, are exempt from the corporate income tax. Section 2 provides a sales tax exemption for materials that are used in the production of the non-ferrous minerals that is similar to the sales tax exemption that currently exists for these kinds of materials that are consumed in the production of taconite. Section 3 establishes a definition of refining in the minerals taxation chapter, and there are no comparable provisions to any of those in the House article.
Mr. Michael?
Section 1 of Article 8 of the House bill reduces the occupation tax rate that applies to non-ferrous minerals from 2.45% to 1.75%.
Ms. Zoff?
Mr. Chair, the Senate provision does not reduce the rate of the tax on the non-ferrous minerals, but it does add a reference to refining the metals and minerals into the description of taxpayers who would be subject to the non-ferrous occupation tax. And then it specifically provides that mining includes the application of hydrometallurgical processes.
Mr. Michael?
The House bill does not have any comparable provisions to that or the next Senate provision.
Section 5 of the Senate article modifies the definition of gross income that's used in the non-ferrous occupation tax. And again, this is to include the minerals, metals or minerals, and to remove the reference to energy resources. Section 6 of the Senate minerals article reduces the rate of the taconite occupation tax. It's currently set at 2.45%, and it's reduced over a period of 11 years to a rate of 0.06%.
Mr. Michael?
The House does not have a comparable provision on the taconite occupation tax. Section 2 of the House bill increases the net proceeds tax. This tax, of course, applies to non-ferrous minerals mining. And the House bill increases it from a 2% rate to 2.7%.
Ms. Zoff?
Mr. Chair, the Senate does not amend the rate of the net proceeds tax, but it does change the imposition, the language referring to the imposition of the tax on the non-ferrous minerals, so it applies to all ores, metals, and minerals that are mined, extracted, produced, or refined in the state.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Section 3 of the House bill modifies the distribution of the net proceeds tax that applies to non-ferrous mining. There are two shares that go, the 5% share to the city and town. Under current law, that goes to the city that has the mine. And what this change does is to divide that share between the city or town with the mine and the city with the production or beneficiation plant in equal amounts. And this is comparable to what's done with the taconite production tax distribution. The next change that's made is a similar change in the 10% share for the school district in which the mine is located. This would be shared between the school district with the mine and with the production plant if those are in different school districts. And again, that parallels the production tax distribution. The next change that's made in the proceeds distribution is that an allocation to the range association of municipalities and school of 1% of the county share is set aside, so the counties would be required to pay over 1% of their share of the net proceeds tax to the RAMs. The final two changes are adjustments in the shares that go to the Doug Johnson Economic Protection Trust Fund, which under present law would get a 5% share. That's reduced to 3%. And a corresponding change is made to the Taconite Environmental Protection Fund, increasing that from 5% to 7%.
Ms. Zoff?
Mr. Chair, the Senate does not modify the distribution of the net proceeds tax in this article. Section 8 of the Senate minerals article provides that the same deductions would apply to the net proceeds tax, and again, this refers to the non-ferrous mining, as are provided under the occupation tax. This would enable them to take deductions for depletion and interest expenses. There's no comparable provision in the House side. Section 9 is another modification of the definitions to include within the definition of metals or mineral products to mean all of those products that are subject to the non-ferrous net proceeds tax. The House does not have a comparable provision to this. The following sections in the Senate article have to do with changes in the rate and the distribution of the taconite production tax. Section 10 strikes a reference to a distribution of taconite production tax proceeds to the Range Association of Municipalities and Schools, which is repealed subsequently in this article. Section 11 modifies the rate of the taconite production tax in two ways. First, the implicit price deflator that applies to the rate is eliminated. And secondly, the existing rate is reduced to account for the fact that the Senate provision eliminates the current distributions that go to the Taconite Economic Development Fund, the Range Association of Municipalities and Schools, and a distribution that would go to the City of Eveleth for the use of the Hockey Hall of Fame, which was set to expire after this year. This provision would permanently set the rate at $2.07 7 4/10% of a ton. The rate for the 2010 production, for example, was $2.38 per ton, and for 2011 would have been roughly $2.41 a ton because of the operation of the implicit price deflator.
Section 4 of the House bill modifies the taconite production tax distribution to towns. This is a 3-cent per ton distribution that under current law increases with the implicit price deflator escalator. What the House bill is to just strike that escalator, the escalation of that distribution, and therefore starting with the 2012 distribution, set it at the 3-cent per ton amount.
Ms. Zoff.
Mr. Chair, members, the Senate distribution to the towns is modified because, in recognition of the fact that they will no longer be taking 1/10 of a cent per ton for the range association, municipalities, and schools. So that is set at 3.1 cents per ton. And that would be made permanent. Then there are additional modifications of the taconite production tax distribution in sections 13 through 16. In section 13, and again, most of these are in recognition of the elimination of the inflator. A number of these distributions have traditionally been inflated if there was a year when the overall rate of the tax was inflated, then particular distributions would also be increased in proportion to that. So the intention of these sections was to keep the distributions at the current level once that deflator was removed. Section 13 maintains that level for the property tax relief account. Section 14 deals with the distribution to the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board. Section 15 does the same maintenance of the current level for the Douglas J. Johnson Economic Protection Trust Fund. And Section 16 provides us 2011 continuation of the 2011 distribution for the Taconite Environmental Fund. The repealer in the Senate article, Paragraph A, repeals the provisions that established the Taconite Economic Development Fund. That was a fund into which a portion of the production tax was distributed every year, and the amount that was put into that fund would be available to the mining companies that made improvements. They could come back and get a credit out of that fund. The distribution to the Range Association, municipalities, and schools, and to the Economic Development Fund, and to the City of Eveleth for the support of the Hockey Hall of Fame were all eliminated in terms. Those distributions were eliminated, and then the provision that related to the distribution of the increases that would be consistent with the production, with the deflator of the production tax are also eliminated. Paragraph B repeals a provision that had appropriated a state aid amount equal to a production tax at a rate of 22 cents per ton. That was a distribution from the general fund that would then go into the taconite production tax distribution. Paragraph C relates to the repeals a provision that set forth particular deductions for the computation of the non-ferrous minerals that is replaced in earlier provisions in the bill.
Mr. Michael.
Article 9 is the miscellaneous article. The first section is a provision that is not in the House bill, but the House passed in House Files 258. I believe in identical form, which allows licensed ambulance services to directly participate in the revenue recapture program rather than going through the county as a claimant agency.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, those were identical.
Mr. Michael.
Section 1 of the House bill modifies the tax incidence study to require the department in preparing the study to reflect in that include information on the distribution of federal taxes that are paid by Minnesota residents.
Ms. Zoff.
Mr. Chair, the Senate has the same provision on the tax incidence study.
Michael.
Article 2 of the miscellaneous article is the appropriations section. It appropriates $15,000 per year, $30,000 for the biennium for the cost of that. Additional information in the tax incidence study on federal taxes, and then also appropriates $35,000 to the department for the zip code, the sales tax zip code study, which Ms. Dalton referred to previously. And those are the appropriation provisions of the House bill.
Is that?
Mr. Chair, the Senate bill appropriation, the same appropriation is made for the expansion of the tax incidence study. The Senate bill did not include the provision requiring a study on the use of zip codes, so there's no appropriation there. Then Section 6 of the Senate miscellaneous article cancels $8,665,000 of the balance in the budget reserve account to the general fund on July 1st of 2011. And Section 5 of the miscellaneous article in the Senate side cancels $216 million of the balance in the cash flow account to the general fund on July 1 of this year.
Mr. Michael.
Article 10 of the House bill is the comparable cash flow provision in the House bill, and it cancels $266 million to the general fund on June 30th, 2013.
Thank you, Mr. Michael and Ms. Zoff. What we'll do here in members, in staff, and guests, we're going to take a brief recess. We'll come back and do the fiscal spreadsheets. We do need to be out of here by 11, so it'll be my intention once we come back to go through the fiscal spreadsheets, have some member questions, and then we will be adjourning for the day. So we are now in recess till 10. We are in recess.